Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. And this is Larry Warren along with my co-host Doug Wells. And we just saw a rainbow fade over Park City. And I think that represents, Doug, the fading of the chance of rain, because the chance of rain finally goes way down after tomorrow.
I was about to start building an ark in my backyard. Holy cow.
It has a few trail riders a little disgusted with all the mud, but more than a few, I would say. But be that as it may, another week begins, and it's Monday, so it's Mountain Money. And interesting show today, some local businesses and a national topic is how we generally break things up. And we're going to start with a book called The Firm, and this is not John Grisham's legal thriller. This one is subtitled The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. And yes, indeed, McKinsey is a company that operates in the background dispensing advice and is not very well known, but we'll learn a lot more about it with the author of a new book that's hit the bestseller list. Duff McDonald will be joining us.
And our second guest, Larry, is going to be Tony Tyler. He's the project manager for the Juniper Landings Townhouse Project out of the Canyons. We're going to talk to Tony more about what's going on out there. And our final guest is going to be Kim Daimling. She is the franchise owner here locally of TapSnap, and think of that as a modern-day photo booth that you can rent for parties and do fun things with. It's kind of the iPhone meets the phone booth from the 1950s.
So. Yeah, it doesn't have to go through a mini dark room, I wouldn't imagine.
No mini dark room. And lots of cool things you can do there just interactively with the pictures. So we're going to talk to those two local guests as well as the author of The Story of McKinsey. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned.
This week it's two natives of the Texas Gulf Coast. First guitar slinger Johnny Winter of Beaumont talking about his youth and milestones in the blues. Then Houston pianist Jason Moran, who found his way to jazz from classical through Thelonious Monk. All that in a honky-tonk jukebox. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Sunday mornings at 11 on KPCW.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. And by the way, Doug, we're headed to a high of 76 today, so just about a perfect day in Park City. And we have on the line with us Duff McDonald. And Duff is a New York-based journalist and contributing editor at Fortune and the New York Observer. He's also written for Vanity Fair, New York, Esquire, Business Week, Condé Nast, GQ, Wired, Time, Newsweek, and others. Well, you're not writing for Newsweek anymore, I guess, Duff. Welcome to Mountain Money. And your book is called The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. And I would imagine, unless you are involved in business at a fairly high level, you don't really know much about McKinsey. Why did you find it interesting enough to write a book about it? And what exactly is McKinsey?
Well, McKinsey are what you call strategic consultants or management consultants. A more colloquial way that people refer to them is corner office consultants. So whatever the most pressing problem your CEO or chairman of the board is facing, there's a good chance they may have hired McKinsey to help them devise a number of alternatives. The reason I found it a worthy topic for a book is that in doing some research on them at the very beginning, I was absolutely shocked by the discovery that these guys are literally everywhere. Any big company in this country, most big companies in the world, any government, Obama hires McKinsey people all the time. They are so deeply entrenched at the highest levels of sort of behind-the-scenes advice that it felt almost like a moral imperative that I alert the world to their existence.
Also, yeah, one of the quotes in your book is, you can't get fired for hiring McKinsey and Company. So it's kind of the go-to place for figuring out what's wrong with your business and how to fix it.
Yeah, and they got started, you know, the genesis of the consulting industry, in particularly of the sort that they're involved in, was early 20th century when American business had that boom of success, and all of a sudden all the giant conglomerates were upon us, like General Motors and DuPont and AT&T, and because of the size of the United States, companies were bigger than they'd ever been before in Europe or anywhere else, and the people who owned and ran those companies were suddenly faced with the challenge of, oh my God, this thing is so big now, how do we control it? How do we run it? And an entire industry sprang up around that. And from the very beginning, it was simple stuff like organizational consulting, like how to do your org chart that everybody sees, you know, stuff that looks like a family tree. And then they've, you know, evolved into different kinds of consulting over the years, whether it's information technology or sort of blue sky strategic thinking looking forward. But essentially, they've always been helping the top management answer whatever the most pressing issues are that they face at any particular point in time.
So, Duff, I find it always interesting to kind of, you know, think of the history and the changes that have taken place in companies. And your book does a great job of laying that landscape. And one of the things that I tell people all the time is, you know, Steve Jobs was not always the Steve Jobs we know, the great presenter. And these great companies were not always these great companies. They had to pivot. They had to morph into these great companies. And I wondered if you could share with our audience kind of the beginnings of McKinsey. How did McKinsey get started? And what was that original vision, and how did that morph over time?
Sure. The founder of the company was McKinsey himself. It was a guy named James McKinsey, who was actually an accountant by training. And his great insight at the beginning of his career was that whereas to that point accounting had generally been used as a backward-looking thing, you know, here's what happened last year, here was our revenues minus our expenses, here was our profit. He spun it around and said, you know what? All these numbers, there's a story in there. It's not just a record of the past. We can use it as a lens to look to the future, and we can use accounting to plan, to figure out how to allocate our resources for next year. Where is growth happening? Let's put some more money over there. Where is it not working so well? Let's take some money out of that. And a lot of that seems very obvious today, but at the turn of that of the past century, it wasn't. So he then took that to management and said, you know, you can, there was a prevailing economic philosophy at the time, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand of the Market. And it was basically an idea that the market can buffet your business and can cause you pain or whatever, and it wouldn't see coming. And during the early part of the century, the consultants and sort of academics said, no, there's the visible hand of management. You can be the master of your own fate, and through strategic planning.
So
that's how McKinsey came into being.
Yeah, so here's a company I found it interesting in your book. So James McKinsey was an accountant, but really felt consultants should use accounting as a tool, but it wasn't the end-all, be-all, which I think a lot of professionals fall into, right? When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And he morphed over time. Originally, it was this budgeting, and then World War II came along, and he was advising big companies. Larry, it was kind of an interesting story against, I guess, like Heinz Ketchup, the government went to and said, can you guys build gliders for us for the war effort? So McKinsey helped companies with that. then after the war.
How do you turn tomatoes into gliders?
Bizarre, isn't it? But I don't know all the details on that. But as far as the morphing, then after the war, the U.S. was in an enviable situation where most of the world's productive capacity had been bombed to smithereens, and the U.S. was the only place that had manufacturing productivity. And McKinsey again advised on, now that you've gone from 20 divisions in your company to 40 because you were able to grow so rapidly, how do you manage that? And then the whole thing on executive compensation started to come into being. And each time McKinsey was able to morph and to position themselves as a leader. And I think that's,
well, you know what?
I was just going to say, to me, that's fascinating.
Beautiful thing.
Go ahead, Duff.
I'm sorry for interrupting there. The beautiful thing about them, which is a point I make a number of times in the book, is every, as you said in your previous question, every company wishes they could pivot, right, and could be very responsive to competitive threats, to some sort of change, to technological change. The beauty of McKinsey is, if you think of what they sell in the abstract, it's advice, right? So they don't actually make anything. So they sell, if they sell advice, it's basically they say to their clients, what is your problem? We can help you with it. So it doesn't matter really what the client's problem is. They sell what their clients are buying. So it is possibly the most morphable business you could even think of. So what is it that your clients need? Well, we'll help you with that. So it's allowed them to actually be, and I make this point in the book, that they're a great way to look at the what we call the American century, because whatever the problem that the most companies were facing at any particular point in time, as you say, the war period, then you have the 70s recession, the IT boom, globalization, McKinsey positions itself very flexibly to help, obviously, because they're businessmen, even though they don't say as much. They like to call themselves professionals, and in the sense of a doctor lawyer, but it's all commerce. And their whole thing is helping people solve the most pressing challenge of the day. And therefore, what McKinsey is actually selling changes every day anybody wakes up. It's whatever their client has decided they want to buy that day.
Yeah, and what makes McKinseyites so smart, and are they? I mean, why are they able to be the experts in everything, whether you're selling canned milk or jet fighters? Why can McKinsey deliver worthwhile advice?
You know, the origins of that, there's a chicken and an egg thing there at the very beginning, which I point out, which is early on they said, we're going to be the corner office guys. And I'm sure someone in the firm said, but what about the fact that we don't actually advise anyone in the corner office?
And that we don't know anything about their business.
How do we go ahead and say that? And there's the old saying, fake it till you make it, right? So from the beginning, Marvin Bower, who is sort of a spiritual godfather of the firm after James McKinsey, was like, look, we're going to control everything we can control to that end. So here's how we're going to dress. Here's how we're going to speak. Here's how we're going to write. Here's how we're going to comport ourselves. And they pretty much tied down everything they could and made it tight and consistent and just sort of kept aiming in the direction they were aiming in. They, you know, cracked a few more. Next thing you know, they're the corner office guys. And the way they've actually held on to that position is that once you're actually in those corner offices, then you get a keeping up with the Joneses thing. I say in the book, there's 10 reasons to hire them. One of them is to know what everybody else is doing, because if all your competition is using them, you know, the consultant isn't going to come in the door and say, oh my God, you better sell Diet Coke because Pepsi's just come up with this new thing. But you will know that your consultant's advice to you is at least informed by an understanding of what everyone else is doing. So once they established themselves in that corner office, all they had to do was hang on to enough of those clients, and then it starts to reinforce itself. But there's a million other reasons you hire them. The nobody ever got fired for hiring IBM is one of them. People hire McKinsey just so they can say to their board or to their employees, you know, we thought this was a thing that we should do, but McKinsey, we asked McKinsey and they agreed with us. And a board will say, McKinsey agreed with you. Oh my gosh, we better do that. You will hire them to send a message that you're serious. McKinsey is a legitimizer of layoffs in many instances. And it's a way for a CEO to deflect responsibility. They can say, I don't want to do this, but, you know, McKinsey came in and said, it's the thing we have to do. So I reluctantly am going to go ahead. You can hire them because you actually have no idea what to do. If you're the CEO and you're sitting there and say, oh my God, do I expand into Asia or South America? I can't decide. You hire McKinsey and they'll say Asia.
I was going to say, I think another reason you hire McKinsey that kind of builds on that is if you have somebody internally do these studies and they end up looking really, really smart to your board, you've now got a challenge, right? There's a guy that might be gunning for your job down the road. If you hire McKinsey, they're not going to try to get the credit. So you get the answer that you need. You get the support that you need to go forward with your vision, but you don't have somebody after your job, which I think has been one of their keys to success.
Absolutely. You know, there's a couple things about that. Like, number one, you're right. It's lonely at the top. So CEOs sometimes can't even ask their most trusted lieutenant because, you know, that guy could obviously have some sort of skewed incentive who thinks, oh, this might not work, but if we go ahead with it and it flops, then he's out of a job and guess who's next in line. McKinsey can be, and that's also another secret to their enduring success, is they have focused very much on relationships with individuals. So, you know, Procter & Gamble may hire them, but the CEO is hiring them. And they are very good at maintaining those relationships. Another thing, too, is, you know, if companies are running leanly or, you know, as leanly as they can at any particular point in time, there's a great argument to be made for bringing in what you might think of as a mercenary force of hardworking, smart MBAs, or, you know, they have all sorts of other people beyond MBAs. But because if it's just a single project, a single question you've got an answer to, sometimes it would be hard to pull that quality of people off whatever else they're actually working on in your company and say, no, go answer this single question. So on some level, while the dollar amounts can be large for most of us to comprehend, you know, a $1 to $5 to $10 million project, it's actually cost effective to bring in outsiders in certain situations just to have them address a particular issue for you rather than you know, distracting your own people and taking their mind off the thing that they're supposed to be there to do every day.
But their advice isn't always great advice. I mean, they told AT&T in 1980 that, oh, cell phones aren't going to catch on. There's only going to be maybe 900,000 subscribers by the year 2000. And 900,
missed that by a little bit.
900,000 turned out to be 109 million. They advised a Time Warner to merge with AOL, and that stands as the worst debacle. Well, there have been many more since, but one of the worst debacles in American business. And their advice to General Motors was terrible when it came to how to compete with Japan. And they helped put Enron business model together. So it's not like if you hire McKinsey, your problems are solved, right?
No, it's not. You know, to the point I was just making, though, One thing that a lot of critics of this industry get wrong is they think that the ultimate decision is the problem that the executive was looking to solve, right? So, you know, sometimes they just need people hire them to get the board off their back or something. But you're exactly right. You know, in the instances where they're being hired to help you predict the future, they are as fallible as the rest of us. They don't have a crystal ball. One of the amazing things about their business, though, you know, if the first thing is its evolving nature, which is it's whatever its clients need over time, the other thing which can be hugely aggravating from an outside perspective is their stance on that is, hey, we're just advisors. We're not the ones pulling the trigger here. So we'll help you lay out all your alternatives, but you got to make the decision. You're the guy holding the steering wheel. So in many situations, McKinsey will say, General Motors didn't respond well to the Japanese threat. We were in there, yeah, but they didn't really, implement our advice properly, which is a great buffer for these guys. I talk about it in the terms power without responsibility, right? These guys are helping decision makers at the highest levels make all sorts of decisions. Yet, if the decision goes wrong, they immediately have this sort of distance. They say, "Oh well, we didn't make the decision. We just sort of gave him the manila folder full of the three options he had. He's the one who picked one."
Duff, I want to circle back to that in just a moment. But you know, first I want to just share my views. I have a great deal of respect for McKinsey. I think they do a tremendous job. They work with hundreds, if not thousands, of organizations throughout the world. So they are going to miss a couple points. But I have many friends that have worked at McKinsey. As you point out in your book, it's kind of a place that many people go for 5 years, 4 or 5 years. They don't spend their entire career there. My friends have gone on to do other things. But I wish when I was an undergrad that I had known about McKinsey, because I didn't. And I think for some of our listening audience or for parents of really bright kids that are doing really well in school, even if your kid's an engineer, you know, they don't just hire MBAs. They'll hire people right out of undergrad that are very, very bright, give them a great experience that they could not otherwise get anywhere else, helping on good projects. And you'll do that for 2 years, and then it's expected if you're an undergrad, you'll go on to business school, or you'll probably look for something else. But it's a great launching pad for many careers. But I want to circle back to that point about power without responsibility. And my last question for you, we have to wrap up, but I found it fascinating that James McKinsey, the ultimate consultant, when he advised Marshall Fields to do this first major layoff, which was one of the first ones in U.S. history, a very, very large layoff, he actually decided to join Marshall Field and help execute on that and actually get in the trenches to do that. Why do you think, and it ultimately killed him, right? It was such a big job. He got sick. He got pneumonia without in the day before penicillin, and it killed him. Why do you think he decided to jump into the trenches with Marshall Fields?
So, just to your first point, absolutely. This is McKinsey's a great place for anyone to start a career. You talked about engineers; they first call themselves management engineers, and the reason why is because they're fact based, they're analytical, they break problems down to their component parts as good as anybody. So the way that McKinsey, the sort of rational approach to problem solving, there's nothing wrong with that. Again, whatever decisions get made in the end could be right, could be wrong, but there's nothing wrong with an analytical approach to problem solving. Back to McKinsey, the reason that he did that is something that plagues a lot of consultants, and that's why a lot of consultants leave, is that they think, you know what? I spent all this time telling people, that are doing interesting things and are in a position to make really sort of big decisions that have impact what to do. And I want to do, not advise. And any CEO who I've spoken to, you know, McKinsey's the most efficient generator of CEOs the world's ever seen. More CEOs running public companies are from McKinsey than from any other specific organization. Maybe Harvard is up there, but it's a different kind of thing. And those guys can get to a point in their career where they think they could do it. And some of them obviously prove very adept at actual management. Lou Gerstner from American Express, then IBM. He turned IBM around. He's ex-McKinsey. But they can get to a point in their career where they think, I'd love to see whether I could do this. I'm in the back room making all the decisions with them or helping them make their decisions. Let me see what I can do. So, but the interesting thing James McKinsey said before he died is he wrote a letter to a friend and he said, I never knew how much harder it was to actually do rather than just say.
Duff,
and
that's
advise. So
That's a great note to end the interview on. McKinsey does a great job, and then ultimately they give the advice, and the companies have to do the heavy lifting, and oftentimes it can be more difficult to execute than people think, and in fact it ended up executing on a consulting advice, ended up killing the founder in McKinsey. So it is very difficult, and kudos to people that do that every day in American society. Duff, we thank you for joining us. Our guest this morning is Duff McDonald. He's the author of The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. Thank you for joining us, Duff.
Thanks for having me, guys. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Duff. And coming up next, Tony Tyler, the project manager for Iron Mountain Group, building a new townhome project in Park City. And it's kind of a sign that Park City is back in the real estate business, that new projects are going up. So we'll talk with Tony about that. For weather, we're looking for a high today of 76. There's still a slight chance of thunderstorms, about 20%. Tonight turns partly cloudy. Still a chance of thunderstorms at 20% on Tuesday. But then the good news is by Wednesday, it becomes mostly sunny, a high of 64, 65. And then by the weekend, we'll be all sunny and into the 70s again. So the rain cycle, if you can hang in there today and tomorrow, will be over by then. And that will be good news. So, back in a minute with Tony Tyler from Iron Mountain Group.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We just had an interesting conversation with Duff McDonald about McKinsey. And Larry, that was, to me, really fascinating. As I said earlier, I'm a fan of McKinsey, and it was fun to learn more about the firm. In studio with us now is Tony Tyler. He's the project manager for Juniper Landing Townhomes. They're not visible from the street, but it's over by the canyons. It's a new project that's going in there. Tony, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you very much.
So, as I said, it's not visible from the street, so there's probably a lot of us here in Park City that don't know what's going on. I know it's over by the Waldorf. Could you tell our audience more about the Juniper Landings, what it is, where it is, and what the vision is you guys are working to create there?
Sure. So we're a townhome development at the canyons. We're located literally right up and behind the Waldorf. And so our units kind of look kind of down into the courtyard currently of the Waldorf. And we're surrounded on three sides by the new golf course, which, of course, everyone's very nice. Excited about.
So. Indeed. And it actually looks like a golf course now.
It does, finally. You know,
Rather than endless piles of dirt, there are bunkers and greens and tee boxes. And
yeah, they just put in the bunkers right in the hole number 9 right behind us and got the cart pass poured. So I'm expecting to see some green pretty soon.
Very fine. Now, we're interested in your project because there haven't been many new projects built in 5 or 6 years, right? Are you one of the first fairly major projects out of the ground now since the Great Recession?
Yeah, we are. I mean, it's one of those things that's, you know, we're a little bit unique in the Canyons area. We've got ours are really more kind of between a typical condo like you would see and a large custom home. They're, you know, 1,500 to 2,500 square feet, 2-, 3-, 4-bedroom townhomes that really live more like a single family home. And so it's a really nice product for, you know, that particular location, especially. And it's fun to have some new construction going on.
So, yes, what I guess, and maybe some of this is proprietary, but where did you find the money to put this on the ground, and what do you see happening that makes this a good product?
Well, we're a private developer. We're not held by any public firm or anything like that. So it was a strategic decision for us. Frankly, we love being out in Utah, and so it's I live here personally, and that was really the motivation for us. And you know, it was just too good of a deal to turn down in the recession. So.
So you bought the property during the recession?
We did.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're based here in Utah. What other projects here in Utah have you guys done?
This is our first out of the ground. We've got another one in Pinebrook. We actually own the old quarry property right next to the Fresh Market there off of the Jeremy Ranch Pinebrook exit there. And that one's planned for 68 townhomes as well.
Okay. So what's happening in the market that made you think this was the time and this was the product?
You know, you start seeing really a lot of the existing product moving, selling. You know, you don't see bank foreclosures nearly as much anymore. You don't see a lot of the short sales going on. Prices are starting to rise. Inventory is going down. And so, you know, when that starts happening, really the market seems a lot more healthy. And so for us, it was kind of a no-brainer to get started on our next phase. So our first phase is done. We've got 20 units built. We've got 13 of those sold. One is currently under contract. Our second phase adds another 5 units plus all of our amenities for the project. So we've got a Junior Olympic-sized swimming pool, hot tub, fitness center, things like that.
So 13 out of 20 units, that sounds really healthy. It sounds like you're connecting the dots and saying now is a good time. Sounds like you're right, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Of those 13 units, are they mostly full-time residents or are they mostly second homes for people?
It's mostly second homes, although we do have one family living there full-time, and you know, they've enjoyed it so far. So, and most of the folks are are second homes for them.
Okay, and do you guys have any association with the Waldorf? Do people at Juniper Landings get to use the facilities at the Waldorf?
We don't, and that's part of the reason why we're pushing forward with our next phase, which includes a lot of the amenities that that need to be for.
Although you're pretty much ski in, ski out, because the gondola lands right at the Waldorf.
Exactly. I mean, we're 50 yards or so from the gondola, so very, very close walk.
And how about the golf course? Is there going to be memberships to the golf course? And by owning there, do you have dibs on a membership, or how does that work?
You know, my understanding is that the golf course is going to be kind of a public-private partnership based on some priority of tee times. And so I don't know, frankly, if that's been worked out yet. My understanding is that it is going to be open to the public, you know, in some form or fashion. Obviously being right on the golf course is,
there's not many places in the country you can live on a golf course and be skiing
and ski
out. That's, I would think that's going to be very appealing.
It'd be
folks.
The condos around Park City Municipal Golf Course would be the other equivalent in Utah. And not a bad combo. What are the price points on these? Are these, by any stretch, affordable full-time housing, or are these
something tells me being on the golf course and ski in, ski out, affordable.
You know, I've probably answered my own question. And next door to the Waldorf, so these are pretty pricey high-end units.
We start in the mid 700s and go up from there. The units are sold fully furnished. I mean, literally turnkey. You bring your toothbrush and your suitcase and move in. So, you know, that certainly adds a little bit of cost, but we think adds a lot of value to them as well.
How about of your 13 buyers? Do they come from any part of the country? Are they all Southern Californians or New Yorkers? Or
you know, they're all over the map. We've got a family from Canada. We've got one from Kentucky. We've got a couple from Florida, Texas, California. So
I think that's healthy. That answer surprised me, but I think it's healthy. How do you get the word out to potential buyers that this project is here and it's available to buy now?
Well, I mean, one of the biggest things for us is just being here in the resort town. I mean, and with Vail now taking over operation of the Canyons Resort, I think we'll get a lot more traffic through. But, you know, that's been kind of the trick is, making sure that people understand that we're there. But anyone looking for a second home, particularly kind of on the larger townhome side, is probably going to look at our development. There's so few out there, especially new construction, that we really fit a good niche there.
So, Tony, let me ask you, if you don't mind, kind of your personal story, because there's a lot of folks in town that are interested in real estate development. It's a tough business to get into. How did you get into real estate development?
Good question. I mean, I basically started right after college. I got a degree in history. I thought I was going to teach. Decided that after I wrote my thesis that wasn't going to happen. Kind of fell into the real estate industry. So I started off as an agent in Colorado selling real estate. I got involved with a few investors there who started doing more of the commercial type of development, office buildings, shopping centers, things like that. Then actually moved down to Utah to do industrial development for a water treatment chemical company. And so after that business sold, I transitioned into these two.
It sounds like since you bought the property during the recession, you probably joined them just before the recession. That mm-hmm. had to be kind of a scary place to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's real estate really is cyclical. I mean, if you look at it over time, you know, yes, it was a very sharp downturn and was far more, I think, protracted than most people thought it was going to be. But in the same token, you know, there's a lot of money out there and a lot of folks still looking for, you know, a second home or third home for that matter. And Park City is a fantastic place to be.
Yeah, we all know that because we live here. Were your buyers first-time Utah property owners, or is this move-up property for a lot of them?
I believe every single one of the sales that we've had have been first-time Utah property buyers. So these are folks that traditionally have been coming here for many years. They've been skiing at the canyons. They've been skiing at Park City, Deer Valley. They've been looking around and then finally decided that it was time for them to buy their own place here.
There's a lot of great things happening in this town right now. I was just reading the headline. I was gone over the weekend, the headline about, you know, renewing the contract with Sundance.
For into the mid-20s.
Which is
great.
Yeah, the town needs – just the fact that the town can think and act strategically like that is helpful. So we've got that going on. Boy, this was a busy summer for businesses here. It seemed like every weekend there was something going on. We've had a couple realtors and some mortgage brokers in talking about residential real estate. Now, Tony, you coming in talking about Juniper Landings, is selling 13, 14 really out of your first 20 units. I really think we've turned the corner and things are starting to look very, very bright both for the state and for Park City.
Oh, and you see for sale signs going up and then
coming down really quickly.
Within a week.
Yeah.
We're hot again.
That's true, and we just finished up the showcase of homes as well for the Park City area, and we had our model unit in the showcase. We had very good traffic, actually. I was a little nervous with some of the large homes that people are always curious to go see,
right.
Positioned right next to those guys. But we had just over 2,000 guest visits over those 3 weekends, so the feedback that we got was really fantastic.
One quick last question, and that's just, you started this project, so you picked up the property in the recession for not a song, but for a lot less than it was slated to sell for, and now the market is good, and then Vail takes over. I mean, to have the cachet of being at the base of a Vail resort has to be so much greater than being at the base of a single resort.
You know, just a stroke of good luck. I mean, my wife and I moved here from Colorado about 10 years ago, and I'm a big fan of Vail. We always had passes, and to have them come in and take over the operation of the resort is just fantastic.
Okay, well, very fine. Tony Tyler, project manager for the Iron Mountain Group, now building Juniper Landing next to, just behind the Waldorf out at the Canyons. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tony.
And we'll be back to talk about TapSnap after this.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We just had a fun conversation with Tony Tyler, project manager for Juniper Landings out by the Waldorf. In studio with us now, we've got Kim Daimling. She's the local franchise owner of TapSnap. And Kim, in the intro at the top of the hour, I described TapSnap as kind of the photo booth of the 50s meets the iPhone. Why don't you tell our audience what I mean by that?
That is a great way to describe it. It's marketed as a photo booth, despite the fact we don't have a booth. It's a 42-inch screen that works very much like an iPad. It's on top of a sleek-designed stand, and guests stand in front of the screen. It takes their picture, and then their picture freezes. And after that, they can write on it. They can doodle. We have digital props like mustaches and hats and even celebrities that they swipe onto the screen. And after they've edited the picture, we can email it to them, and we put it on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
So I saw in your literature, like you can, you talked about the celebrities, you can actually crop in where it looks like, in this case, Matt Damon is standing next to you.
Yes. I was at the Red Apple Gala last Saturday, and we had a guy who happened to fit Matt Damon's physique perfectly. So we put Matt Damon's head on this guy, and I had a lot of calls saying, "How cool, you met Matt Damon up at Montage." And
right.
I didn't correct him.
Very fine. So I presume that is the highest and best use of TapSnap, is to rent it for a big party.
Exactly.
As one of the entertainment features.
Yes, and it's also really catching on with sponsored events like expos, like fundraising walks. I did an Alzheimer's Walk for Hope a couple weeks ago. And every at the end of the event, you know, we've directed a lot of traffic to the nonprofit's Facebook page, so that increases their likes and just gives it an organic feed. We also have a printout at the end of all of the email addresses we've collected, so the sponsors are then able to follow up with a group that's, you know, it's an accurate email list because people want to see their pictures, so they provide the right email address.
It's actually really clever. I mean, if I had gone and done a picture and giving you the email so I could get the picture afterwards, I wouldn't have thought about the corporate follow-up that could come later. Talk to us, and I think for nonprofits in particular, it's really helpful to get those Facebook likes. How does that happen? How do they end up with Facebook likes from the email?
Well, people love to have their picture taken, and they love to have a copy of it. As you know, we all know with iPhones, everybody's constantly taking a picture of themselves and sharing it out with friends. So this one, it's an exceptionally high-quality picture, so people are more excited to have it. And then we designate a Facebook page. So, for example, like Mountain Town Music, we did an event for them last month, and they're very into social media. So mm-hmm. every picture that was taken went on to their Facebook page, and if you wanted to find your picture, you would have to visit the Mountain Town Music's Facebook page. You go there, you like it, you share it, you tag it, and that just, you know, kind of spreads like wildfire.
Right.
Really throughout clever. Social media.
It's really clever if you're a local business trying to think of, you know, how do I increase my social presence? As you said, Mountain Town Music is very socially adept. But there's a lot of local businesses that are trying to figure this out, and this might be a simple way for you to get your first 100 likes or so.
Exactly. Yeah. It really does increase the likes and the tags and the shares and spreads the word.
Now, there's competition out there. There are digital photo booths that spit out the traditional panel of four, a strip of three or four pictures, right?
But you don't get Matt Damon in those photos.
That's true. But we do that too. We do. We print out 4x6 photos as well as the traditional photo booth strips.
Okay. Well, are those available that night or
instantly?
You email them? Okay.
Yep, like 20 seconds.
So it's the edited photos that need to be emailed and printed yourself.
We can do both.
You
so,
can do those
so
too.
So there's an edited okay. picture. We can print it out on site. We can email it to you, and we can upload it to social media.
You know, and the whole photo booth has become retro and popular again. I was kind of surprised. I've got a 13-year-old daughter, and I was telling Larry before the show, at her eighth-grade dance, they rented a photo booth.
And
I was kind of, yeah, I was kind of surprised. And then there was a birthday party where they rented a photo booth. And I remember them being popular when I was kids, and maybe they've always been popular, and now my kids are that age. But it seemed like for a while they kind of went out of vogue, but now they're coming back. Are you seeing that?
I am. I think there's definitely a time and a place for the photo booth. It's still reminiscent of going into, you know, the drugstore and
making goofy faces.
Yeah, and you're kind of behind the curtains. Nobody really knows what's, you know, I think people are feel free to make whatever goofy faces or do whatever. but part of TapSnap's appeal is people are sort of hamming it up in front of the screen, in front of their friends.
The thing about TapSnap is it's not behind a curtain. Everybody else can see what you're doing, and it makes it entertaining for the rest of the crowd, even if they're on the sidelines watching.
Exactly. And the photo bombing is, you know, usually out of control. There's always like three or four people that sort of lurk around TapSnap, and they just wait for the right moment, and they'll, you know, jump into the middle of the picture or, you know, do the rabbit ears or some sort of, you know.
Photo bombing. Hadn't heard that term before.
Oh, yeah.
But that's what that is.
That's what that is.
Jumping into someone else's picture.
Very good. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so how what does it take to set this up? How big is it? Are you a one-woman band here?
Pretty much, yeah. I usually have somebody help me set it up. It takes about 20 minutes to set up. And it's the total footprint is about 5 foot by 5 foot. It's about 6 feet tall. Doesn't take up much space at all, and it's a really nice-looking unit that blends in with any decor. And then we like about 6 feet in front of us to give people room to pose and do their thing. And I mean, depending on the group, I had a group where we fit the whole convention group in there. We had 126 people in it. So
wow.
Anywhere from...
Were they all doing rabbit ears on the guy next to them?
A little bit.
So, Kim, how did you decide to get into this? So it's a franchise. You made the
Correct.
Decision that you were going to invest the money for the franchise. Were you looking at multiple franchise opportunities, and how did you decide on TapSnap?
I did. We looked into several opportunities out there, and I didn't really want to manage a storefront. I have a background in event planning, and I'm sort of an amateur photographer. So when we saw
Perfect.
Yeah, when we saw this model, it was just, it seemed perfect. And so I did my due diligence with investigations and phone calls and research. And this group out of Canada just seemed fantastic. And I was in the very first group of franchisees.
So which is a little scary.
Very scary, yeah. For sure. Yeah. But now they have a new group about every month. And there's over 50 of us around North America now.
Well, great. So what? How does the franchise work? Quickly, do you buy the machine? You lease it? How do you?
Yep, we buy it. We bought the machine, and then we just work with them to set up our event codes. And they're the ones who are in charge of the software and all the behind the scenes magic. That's not my forte. I let them do that.
Well, it's a big decision. We're glad it's off to a strong start with you. Our guest is Kim Daimling. She is the franchise owner here locally of TapSnap. Kim, if folks want to get in touch with you for a local event, how would they find you?
Two ways. You can give me a call. My number is 435-640-4999, or you can email me at kimd@tapsnap.net.
All right. Well, kimd@tapsnap.net. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll be back to wrap Mountain Money after this.
Tune in to KPCW every Tuesday morning at 9 to hear This Green Earth.
We'll cover environmental issues from local to global, from snowpack to giant squid,
geothermal energy to gray wolves,
and honeybees to sustainable chocolate. Brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough,
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
Back to the final minutes of Mountain Money. So, Doug, you're very high on McKinsey, and I threw in those examples of bad advice just to say nobody's perfect.
Yeah, no. And when you're dealing
at high levels, when you get it wrong, it's big.
It is big. And one of the things we didn't have time to talk to Duff about is, I just think it's amazing that they can take folks, pretty much either out of undergrad or right out of the MBA program, put them in a team, and their culture is such that as a team they can succeed and they can do good work for the CEOs of these big companies.
Well, I would just automatically as a CEO think, what are a bunch of kids, 25-year-olds, what do they know about life and business to be giving me advice?
Well, and they're doing a lot of the analysis.
But it's a blended team.
Exactly.
Too. And,
exactly.
And it's all a matter of that. So
it was an interesting story. I told you I was in Reno over the weekend, and so I listened to the book on tape as I drove across a desert with a whole lot of nothing between here and Reno. And it was a really fascinating story, much of which I hadn't heard before. For instance, James McKinsey's background. He grew up as a barefoot farmer in Arkansas. And to go from that background to the company that he created, to me, is quite impressive.
Wow. Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, that was our first guest, Duff McDonald. The book is The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. And we followed that up with conversation about a new Juniper Landing townhome development over by the Waldorf, and then Kim Daimling has a fun little franchise she found. So
yeah, and I was really encouraged by Tony and hearing the success they're having on that development. As we talked, things really are turning around, and I think the next couple years are going to be really exciting for Park City.
Yeah, so I want to thank our great sponsors, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group just joined us a couple of weeks ago, and Park City Chamber is a sponsor, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. We thank you all for helping bring Mountain Money to us. Again, the weather, a 20% chance of showers through tomorrow, but then it gets sunny and should get better as the weekend approaches. So, very good. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells. Doug, great questions as always. I
and,
always
and great guests. We have to thank Beth for lining up our great guests. Thank you, Beth.
And next week we have Peter Shankman, the author of Nice Companies Finish First, Why Cutthroat Management is Over and Collaboration is In. And we'll also talk about olive oil on Main Street and home security. So thanks for joining us. This has been Mountain Money, only in Park City, only on KPCW Park City.